Thanks for coming. Firstly, I'm going to start with a fire briefing, which is novel. So if the fire alarm goes off, you can follow the corridor and go down the stairs on the left in orderly fashion and follow Marianne, who is not here because she is herding people up the stairs in the opposite direction to find this room. But she would be wearing a big fire vest. And so follow her, don't panic, everything will be okay. In terms of who I am, I'm Matt Bartlett and I'm a research fellow at the Faculty of Law, and I'm sort of affiliated with the New Zealand Centre for ICT Law, which is based here in Auckland Law School, and also the AI Forum. So that's sort of how I fit into it. That's how I ended up here. And the other thing that I was going to say before I get into it was just why I'm doing this and why I sort of landed on this as a topic, which is that at a high level, I think we're in the middle of quite a significant paradigm shift where a lot of technological change has happened in a very short space of time, and it's changed big parts of the way that we live and big parts of how society functions and all the rest. And I think we're only now starting to really grapple with what that means. And so what I'm trying to do here is sort of my contribution to that grappling, and in particular grappling with Facebook and Google as two of the big gatekeepers, two of the big players in that transition to an online world. So that's my motivation. In terms of how this seminar is going to work, I've had to kind of constrain myself a little bit because I could, you know, talk about all kinds of different avenues and there's all kinds of different things that we could talk about, but I'm going to focus on three in particular. But first, I'm going to give a bit of an overview of Facebook and of Google. And you know, you guys probably don't need too much of an introduction to Facebook and Google, so that will be a very short overview, but I'm going to focus in a little bit more on how they make money, and so zero in on that, because I think that's a really important piece to the puzzle, and that's probably the key context for then the rest of the seminar. So moving on from the overview, basically we're asking the question, are Facebook and Google too powerful? As has already been pointed out, that is a very simplistic and not very helpful question, but it makes for a very great hook. And so obviously that's a really hard question to answer yes or no to. And instead, what we're going to be doing today is going into different aspects of Facebook and Google, and kind of the broader way in which they work and affect society. The first of those is data. So looking at how our data gets collected, what they do with our data, and in particular, how much choice we have in the matter. And it's not as simple as saying we have no free choice, but it's looking at some of the ways in which Facebook and Google have constructed their business models in some ways to take away choice at key intervals. And so to me, that's a really important part of the puzzle here in terms of whether they're too powerful. To what extent are we making a genuine free choice to use the products and give them the data and for them to do whatever they will with the data? Next, and kind of separate to data, is thinking about sort of public implications of Facebook and Google. And so I've called this encroachment on the public square. And so my thinking here is to work through the ways in which Facebook and Google are changing the way that our democracy works, but not just, and I'm sure a lot of you know about elections and Cambridge Analytica and that kind of thing, and I will talk about that, but also just on a higher level, how Facebook and Google are gatekeepers for an increasing amount of what is important in society, what has value, what matters. All of these questions are increasingly moderated by the Facebook and Google platforms. And as I'm going to try and explain and prove, I guess, they're not neutral platforms, and they're not neutral in some pretty important and sometimes problematic ways. And so looking at the ways in which, I guess, Facebook and Google are distorting the public square, if you like. Next, looking at Moore's law versus state law. So what Moore's Law is, if you don't know, is it's basically handy shorthand for technological development. So for a very long period of time, engineers have managed to double the transistors that can fit on a microchip. And if you don't know what that means, that is fine. And I honestly don't really do either, because that's computer engineering stuff. But the key takeaway is that for a long period of time, technological development has happened consistently, steadily, and in a way that is exponentially increasing. And so my point with that third idea is that while this technological development has been happening and Facebook and Google have been building their quite hefty moats around themselves, state law, i.e. governments responding to Facebook and Google, have stood still, and kind of looking at how that then creates monopolies and maybe some of the problems that flow from that. Okay, so that's my kind of reasonably complex sort of look at what too powerful actually means. So we're going to go in piece by piece and try to kind of wrestle with some of these hard questions. Yes, so basically data, democracy, monopoly, kind of in that order. But first, and then like I have up there, I'll quickly talk about where we'll go from here, not us personally, although we can if you'd like, but more kind of in society, as regulators, as lawmakers, what happens from there, what is happening, what should happen. And then we can take some questions. Okay, but first, like I signaled, let's just have a quick look at what our subjects are this evening. So Facebook and Google, like I said at the start, I don't feel like most of you will need too much of an introduction as to what Facebook and Google are, but I just thought I'd make 2 points as context for us as we go into the subject in more depth. The first is that Facebook and Google are empires, and they are not just the applications that you deal with. And what I mean by that is, take Google for instance. So Google has a parent company called Alphabet, and Alphabet is a conglomerate of different kinds of technological applications and other companies. So when I talk about Google over the next hour, I'm also talking about YouTube, I'm also talking about Android, Google Chrome, Gmail. You see all the various Google applications. You know, Google's tried to get its hands into as many things as it possibly can. And I think that is really important context, is that we need to treat all of those different applications as what they are, which is belonging to the one big umbrella organization. So Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, he has huge influence over YouTube, Android, Google Chrome, all these different things. They are part of the Google picture. So when we talk about Google, it's not just the search engine, it's all of this other stuff as well. And it's also true for Facebook, maybe to a little bit of a lesser extent. But Facebook has done a great job, in some senses, of becoming the de facto social layer of the internet. And what I mean by that is they bought Instagram. Instagram turned into a giant. They spun off Messenger. So some people don't realize that Messenger and Facebook are the same thing, but they are. And WhatsApp is another example. WhatsApp, these are behemoths, right? So, you know, that's the stat that I've put on the screen, that Facebook reaches 3.5 billion people each month. And I mean, I could just stand here and rattle off giant, unimaginable statistics all evening. I won't, but one more is that Google does 4 billion searches per day. So kind of like I said at the very start, I think it is important to have a sense of the scale of which we are talking here. Like this is a big deal. Like Facebook is not some fun app, and if you thought that, you probably wouldn't be in the room to begin with, but neither is Google. These are very powerful, very influential businesses, and they control other kinds of applications that you might not immediately associate with them, but that is part of the picture. They are empires. Okay, the other thing that I wanted to draw out here was the COVID effect. Because, you know, let's not kid around, Facebook and Google were pretty big before 2020, but what COVID has done and the associated kind of lockdowns all around the world has accelerated the speed at which the online sphere has consumed and in some ways replaced the physical sphere. So here's some statistics. I'm sure some of this is pretty relatable content to some of you, but it's a huge across-the-board increase in people engaging in this online world. So they're watching 54% more shows and streaming services, and we tend to associate that with Netflix, but YouTube is the biggest streaming, it depends on the metric you use, but in some metrics, YouTube is the biggest streaming platform, not Netflix. YouTube is owned by Google. Obviously, spending more on social media, messenger services, these are activities that are just completely dominated by Facebook and Google. It's not to say that there aren't other applications that do similar things, but we really do have to have a clear sense of the scale of how much Facebook and Google are dominating here. So, if you're spending 43% more time on social media, there's a really good chance that you're doing it on Facebook or Instagram or one of the Google platforms. Okay, so that's the other piece of the puzzle. They're very big, and COVID has accelerated their influence and the extent to which they dominate big parts of our lives. Okay, next, like I said, we're going to talk about how they actually make money. And I think Facebook and Google have done a good job over the years of obfuscating this. And so I've tried to boil it down because I really think it's pretty simple. Like I've simplified it a little bit here, but not as much as you might think. So how do Facebook and Google make money? They collect a lot of personal information from you. They use that information to get a good idea of who you are, how you act, how you're likely to act in the future, so they can predict your behavior. And in particular, they can predict when you are likely to buy something and what you are wanting to buy at a particular moment. Then they sell those predictions, or they auction off those predictions in a very sophisticated, completely automated auction market to advertisers. And so that process is kind of delegated to algorithms again. And advertisers pay a lot of money, it turns out, for very accurate predictions about how people will act. And then they do it again. And that's not, like, this is not a takedown, right, necessarily. Like, it's advertising is not new. Collecting information about people, you know, for advancing a business model is not necessarily new either. But there are some changes in terms of immense scale and the degree to which these companies can understand you to a pretty extreme degree. And that is partly a consequence of the products that they have rolled out over time. So this is the kind of this idea, and the reason I've got that picture on the screen is just to really show how dependent Google is on this fundamental way of making money. So most of the things up there, Google Ads, Network Ads, YouTube, that all reflects this model, which is collecting personal information, getting a good idea, running that through your predictive algorithms, generating predictions about how someone will behave, and then selling those predictions. So I think one thing that you hear a lot, which is not true, is that Facebook and Google are selling your data. I almost wonder if Facebook and Google encourage that idea, because it's sort of demonstrably not true. What they're doing is actually something that's a lot more profitable, which is sit on your data and generate predictions about how you will behave every single day or every minute or every second. So why would they sell your data to another company that can then make the same kinds of predictions when that is their treasure trove? That's why Facebook and Google are so valuable, because they can use that data to generate insights into how you'll behave in perpetuity, basically. And so that is the business model that we're grappling with here. And the one other thing I thought I'd say on this is that this is a useful way to understand some of the developments in Google and Facebook over the years. Because, I mean, it could be easy to think, all these different Google products are just helpful. Things like Gmail, things like Google Maps, Android, all this stuff. It's not immediately clear, unlike a search term, how that might translate into data. But when you dig a little bit deeper, it almost always comes back to another kind of avenue for Google to extract data from you. The most extreme example of this is that I really enjoy is Pokemon Go. Hands up who has heard of Pokemon Go. Great. All right. Well, you might be shocked to understand that Pokemon Go and Niantic, which was a development company, is a Google creation. So Pokemon Go was built on Google Maps and the location tracking software that underpins Google Maps. And what they were looking for when they came up with Pokemon Go were ways to get people to walk around and have their location constantly tracked, basically feeding that data back to Google. So when you see, like, back in 2016, when it was the craze, when you saw all of these, you know, people in their young 20s and teenagers and all this stuff running around like chasing Pikachu, like, they are feeding data back to Google. And I say that because it sounds like a little bit dystopian, but it's kind of reflective of how all these different applications that are seemingly unrelated to Google at the end of the day come back to contribute to this giant moat of data. And that data, because it allows for increasingly predictive predictions about how you will behave, are why Google is so good at what it does, and it's why its ads are so profitable. Because advertisers, like I said, ads aren't new, right? We've had ads in newspapers for a very long time, but newspapers are so, you know, a newspaper ad is necessarily generic. It cannot be specifically targeted at you, what you care about, how you're feeling on a particular day. And that is the business model of Facebook and Google. So sit on that for a bit. That's kind of the context. So basically where we're at is we've got big tech. Big tech's pretty big, and it's gotten bigger over COVID. Then we've got this business model that is built on data collection and prediction. Okay. Next, let's talk about the first kind of argument or kind of area that I want to explore, which is data and choice. And I've already talked a little bit about it back then when I was talking about the business model. Right. Let's think about data and choice. And it's hard to really get to grips with this without understanding some of the history behind Facebook and Google and where their products come from. And so a really good example of this, and you still see in the way Google is designed today, and Facebook for that matter, the linkages with Stanford's Persuasive Technology Lab. So in 2007, a psychologist called BJ Fogg had this brilliant idea to run a series of experiments about how to essentially hook people on technology. And I mean, it's hard to know how much blame to place on him, because he's an academic psychologist and he possibly wasn't aware that all of these, like, very hungry VCs and future VCs and future Facebook engineers were just sitting there taking notes being like, this seems like a good idea. But a couple of the things that emerged from the Persuasive Technology Lab are lots of the things that we take for granted as part of online life. Things like push notifications, the dopamine hit when your notifications light up and you get like another 5 likes on your Instagram. That then the sharp red color and the way if you reload it, you get more. That is designed to set off dopamine hits in your brain. They studied cocaine, like, they're not subtle in this class. And there are lots of examples of this that found its way into how these technological products are designed. So other examples, infinite scroll. So many people take infinite scroll for granted, but it's a design choice that Google and Facebook have made over a period, have made from an early stage that they've carried through. But if you sit back and think about it, it's not necessarily, it doesn't follow that if you have kind of a list of results, or if you have like a news feed, that it has to be have infinite scroll, right? We're so used to that, and then you can just literally keep scrolling, sometimes for hours and hours. But that is something that has been built into the architecture of the technology, and that is something that comes from this legacy of, you know, I know it sounds hyperbolic, but it's actually not. They've sat around and they've thought quite hard about how to hook people into their systems. And we have to understand that in the context of the business model discussion that we just had. Discussion, me talking. Which is, you know, getting more data into Facebook and Google so that they can then mine it for more and better predictions about how you behave. Now, if you're in the system because of the feedback loops that we were talking about, so the notifications, the dopamine hits, all of that stuff, you're going to be in the system for longer, you're giving them more data, they soak that data in, they get better predictions, and the cycle kind of continues. And I guess when we sit back and we're like, how powerful are Facebook and Google? Are they too powerful? One question that comes to my mind is, how much choice are we getting in this exchange? It's clearly true that Facebook and Google give us like some pretty incredible products. And like, I'm very, very far from like a Luddite who thinks that we should throw all of the technology out and just start again with, quills. But at the same time, there's a difference between being a Luddite and trying to understand the basic infrastructure of Facebook and Google's model. And I guess my point here is that it's been built in a certain way to enhance these feedback loops and keep you in the system. Right, thinking about data as well. Data is not necessarily a bad thing, of course. And a lot of the time, data makes products better, and then it is better for their users. And no one is arguing that that's not true. But the interesting thing is, in the life cycle of Google, the history of Google, the business, who have kind of is the first big tech kind of company, and with the kind of business model that I'm describing, they grapple with this. And for the first few years of Google, they were collecting all this information, but they were strictly using the information to make Google search results better. And then there was a design choice that they made in the late noughties, where it was like they made the decision to collect other kinds of data, personal data, that actually didn't make the search results any better, but made this ad targeting model better. So there's different kinds of data. We're not saying, very few people are saying that they should not be allowed to keep data and use data to make products better. But it's about just asking that question, where do we draw the line? What kind of data is acceptable and has a business rationale, and how much data we think goes too far, crosses some line in the sand, and we say, no, they don't need that data. That's just to know more about us for the purpose of ads. I thought I'd break up my monologue with a few videos, and one of them is setting out, I think, the broader ambition of what Facebook and Google are trying to achieve. So this is a video of Sergey Brin, who was a founder of Google, and he's wearing some spectacularly ugly glasses that you might remember called Google Glass. So this is a Google product that did not take off, presumably because no one wanted to look like that. But the focus here is not to laugh at Google Glass, but just to listen to Sergey's TED Talk, because halfway through, he said something that I think is pretty illustrative of Google's wider ambition here.
My vision when we started Google 15 years ago was that eventually you wouldn't have to have a search query at all. You just have information come to you as you needed it. And this is now 15 years later, sort of the first.
So he talks about how Google Glass does that. Google Glass did not do that. But if you take a step back, just think about what the Google founder is saying about what Google is trying to do. Google wants so much information about you that they can predict what you want at any given moment before you type in a search query. And I think that's something worth thinking about, because that reflects an incredibly ambitious vision, but potentially a quite dystopian one as well. Because if you think about how much data a company would have in order to have that level of prediction where it can know exactly what you want and exactly how you feel and all the rest, I mean, my view would be that no company should be allowed to have that much information. And I think the other important thing about that example is it explains a little bit about how Google reflects actually a certain ideology, and that ideology is a very Silicon Valley ideology about how more tech is better. And you know, when people try to kind of regulate them and talk about regulating them, the response from Silicon Valley is usually, you don't understand the vision, just trust us. And I think that's worked for a long time in the sense that people have held off Silicon Valley, but I think, you know, their long-term aims are worth dwelling on. Okay, I'll leave you with that, and we'll talk about consent and choice a little bit more. And I think this is a pretty straightforward point, which is that my view is that Google and Facebook users cannot really be said to consent to everything that we were just talking about in terms of Facebook and Google's collection of data, analytics of data, and then using it in various ways. It will shock probably none of you to learn that the average time spent reading terms and conditions is 14 seconds. In that study, they also worked out how much time it would take a lawyer to understand the document. And it would take a lawyer 45 minutes. So we've got a terms and conditions document, it was Google's, that would take a lawyer 45 minutes to read. The average person, like 14 seconds is probably how much time it takes them to skip to the bottom and press on, you know. And so I think we can already say, are users really consenting to all the various things that are being done with their data? But even if you don't buy that, you say, actually, no, they could read it, they choose not to. We can move on and look at how the data is actually used. Because in those terms and conditions, those they are limited, like they're very long, right? They're 45 minutes to read, but they still cover just a very small fraction of the different ways in which your data might be collected and might be used. And so an example of this, which I think is kind of crazy, from 2019, was that there was a study that Facebook, which of course receives data from other apps that you sign up to using Facebook, was collecting data from an app called Flow Period and Ovulation Tracker. So Facebook was taking all this information in about people's ovulation and was then sending them ads for maternity genes. But sometimes before that person had done a test to see if they were pregnant, so, you know, that is the, you know, could you really say that user is consenting to being targeted for being pregnant or being targeted in that way with maternity genes when they are not even aware of the data that Facebook has taken about them and then sold off to an advertiser for maternity genes? I would say no. I would say you can't consent to that. The last thing about this is, even if you say, okay, well, maybe they can't consent to that, but if they don't go on Facebook and they live in a cave and just decide not to have social media, that protects them. Fortunately, the answer to that is also no, because Facebook and Google have very, very, very advanced AI. And one thing about personal information, your personal information, is that it contains a lot of information about your friends and family, other people in your life. And this can take a whole bunch of different forms. It might be that you went to an event, Facebook knows you went to an event, and there are pictures of you and someone else, and Facebook can usually identify that person whether they're on Facebook or not by triangulating other kinds of data. Another example is with health. Facebook might understand that a family member has a hereditary disease and might be able to work out that other family members are likely to have that disease and sell predictions about that, even when that person might not have actually been on Facebook or consented to that in any way because they didn't even go through the terms and conditions. So it's really hard to opt out of the system, is my takeaway point here. And that when we're thinking about whether Facebook and Google are too powerful, how much choice do you have when you don't understand, because no one understands exactly how this data processing works, how Facebook's ad system works, and when other people's data is reflecting information about you. That's an incredibly hard system to escape. And so that's one piece of this puzzle, is data and choice and whether we actually have it. Okay, I'm next gonna turn to a bit of a separate point. So encroachment on the public square. What do I mean by that? Right, so when we think about what a public square is, and this is kind of like in a romanticized Victorian English public square, it's where it's kind of like a metaphor for how people meet and talk and communicate and share information, maybe with a town crier. You know, you get the picture. And for a long period of human history, that is somewhat reflective of how information was exchanged and how relationships developed between people in society. And so this is a bit of a different point, but I think there's something really important about the fact that to, I think, a large degree, the virtual space, the virtual world, has become that town square. The virtual world, which Facebook and Google dominate, has become the main place where people share information, get their news, get their understanding about the world, get to know each other even. I've got a few statistics here. The majority of people around the world when polled, this is across a lot of different countries, social media was how the majority of people got their news. And when of social media, Facebook was by far the biggest. But then the majority did not trust social media. So we're in this terrible situation where people are getting most of their news from Facebook and other kinds of social media. They don't trust it, but they keep coming back to get their information from there. And I think we can see the strength of some of those network effects and feedback loops that we talked about in an earlier part of the seminar. And so we've got this situation where the public square is largely online, and that is where a lot of people get their information and news. That is not in and of itself a bad thing, I think. I don't think that, you know, necessarily because it's online, it must be worse. But what I think we've got to reflect on is the way that Facebook and Google have kind of become the public square, but they are not neutral spaces. And I think this is a really important point, because when all of this information is being traded, this news is being shared, these relationships are being developed, that is not in some vacuum, but in a world with algorithms and rules that are shaped, that have some pretty, in some ways, some problematic design choices. So a really easy one, which I'm sure all of you have heard of, is this idea that the algorithms on your Facebook feeds and other apps will prioritize engagement. So if you have like a long policy document about tax, it's very unlikely to go viral. Very few people are going to read it. But what Facebook and Google do is accelerate the speed at which something that people will engage with will gain traction online. And that's quite a fundamental point, because that changes a whole bunch of other stuff. So it also changes how the media act, because the media, already struggling before Facebook and Google, have seen their revenue, you know, controlled or really, really hit hard by the need to adapt to a social media world. And so lots of media organizations have struggled with that. And the ones that have done well are generally the ones that have adapted to putting engaging content online, whether we might think that engagement is good or not. So Fox and Breitbart are great examples of this, as some of the biggest and the biggest growing kind of news agencies on Facebook, because they adapted their business model much faster than more mainstream media outlets to this new world, this new public square where Facebook and Google have designed it in certain ways. And one of those is how algorithms have biases. And some of those biases are really obvious, like this idea of engagement. We know that sends certain content to the top of the newsfeed and keeps other content hidden from people. But there are other kinds of biases as well with how these algorithms work. So this is an example that was literally sent to me today about how, as a study of how Facebook's algorithm shows different job ads to different people depending on their gender. So it was a study of, there was a software engineer role at NVIDIA. Shockingly, the Facebook algorithm almost, you know, displayed that ad to men. So, you know, then there was also a retail assistant at a jewelry store, and then Facebook's algorithm decided to show that ad mostly to women. And there are all kinds of ways in which these biases creep into the system because the algorithms don't necessarily know better. It's not necessarily that Google and Facebook have designed the algorithms to be sexist and racist and all the rest, but the data pools often have distortions. The data pools that are training those algorithms often have problems. And it has to be said that the engineers who are developing those algorithms in Silicon Valley are almost all white men. And so they're not necessarily on the hunt for these kinds of biases. And throughout the process, it is usually a particular demographic that is designing these systems. And so we shouldn't really be surprised when the systems then come out reflecting certain biases. And that's only a problem, well, that might be a problem in and of itself, but it's especially a problem when those algorithms change the way society understands the world and changes the way society takes in news, takes in information, all the rest. So that's my point about how they're not neutral. They have algorithms. Those algorithms are really important at deciding what gets said and what gets understood. The other point here is that there are no gatekeepers or very few gatekeepers in an online world. And that can be a really good thing because we don't want to be a Pollyanna about what the world used to look like before Facebook and Twitter, because, you know, legacy media institutions were often quite limited in what they would cover, right? They had their own biases. There were other things that changed how information was shared that were not great. So it's not to say that the old system was perfect, but to say that when you have no gatekeepers or very few gatekeepers, because Facebook and Google insist that their space is a neutral space, that lets these algorithms shape the way that discourse happens. And I think that's quite a big deal. I've got a kind of a philosophical point about how Facebook and Google are shifting what even matters in the first place. And I'm not going to go too far down that, but essentially, I mean, I'd ask you to think about how the fabric of social relationships as well have changed. So it's quite easy to pick on information and misinformation, but I think there are some pretty important ways that when a lot, and obviously with COVID, when we're all at home and socializing with friends over these platforms, we don't have much choice. But I think there's some interesting and sometimes concerning insights into how kids who are growing up in this world are growing up differently by virtue of a big chunk of their world being natively online. And I'm not saying I've got brilliant insights as to what those issues are or what we should do about them, but just to flag that that's another way in which Facebook and Google, by controlling the public sphere, are changing the way that social relationships happen as well. And yeah, like I said, it is really important to understand that when we're thinking about Facebook and Google, we know who is designing Facebook and Google and where those design decisions have come from. I have an amusing slash kind of horrifying anecdote, which I do not hear enough given how outrageous it is. But Mark Zuckerberg, when he set up Facebook in his Harvard dorm, it was originally called FaceMash. And this is not a joke. Zuckerberg designed FaceMash to source student photos of female students at Harvard And then if you were a user of Face Mesh, there would be a randomly selected pair of female photos and you would vote on which one you thought was hotter. And then those results would be shown to anyone else who logged on. And so, you know, like, okay, Zuckerberg was, you know, a late teenager and a moron and probably a dickhead. But, you know, I do think that, and it's, Facebook is not Face Mesh in Zuckerberg's dorm anymore, but I think that is somewhat instructive at thinking about what the core of these platforms are, because it's not necessarily a huge respect and love for public institutions and those kinds of things. Okay, what I was going to show you next was, this is from a congressional hearing where Zuckerberg was on the stand and he's being, often these congressional hearings go very badly because lawmakers are not particularly well informed. This one went quite well. The interviewer is, or the questioner is Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, and she is asking Zuckerberg about how he polices lies on his platform, or how he doesn't police lies on his platform. So I'll show that video now.
I run ads targeting Republicans in primaries saying that they voted for the Green New Deal.
Oh, that's very quiet.
Would I be able to run advertisements on Facebook targeting Republicans in primaries saying that they voted for the Green New Deal? I mean, if you're not fact-checking political advertisements, I'm just trying to understand the bounds here. It's fair game.
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I think
so. You don't know if I'll be able to do that. Do you see a potential problem here with a complete lack of fact checking on political advertisements?
Well, Congresswoman, I think lying is bad, and I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad. That's different from it being
Anyway, so that's basically an accurate summary of Zuckerberg's response, which is he doesn't have a response, right? Like, in fairness, Facebook are in this position where they are very, very desperate to not police what is true on their platforms. But when you don't police, and that's because it's very hard to, you know, police truth, and there's a tough and quite nuanced thing to have to do. But on the other hand, when you don't police truth on your platform, and that platform is then the de facto way information is shared in the world, then we've got some serious problems, like Ocasio-Cortez said. I'm going to zero in on one specific problem that we have, which is that Facebook can change the way that you vote in some very real and somewhat scary ways. And I'm zeroing in on this because you know, when we talk about how Facebook can influence you into buying something, it might not be so obvious what the harm of that is, especially if Facebook is like, well, this person wants something, therefore I'm going to buy that thing. I think that can be concerning because it knows all that information about you, but that might not, that doesn't erode democracy per se. But what happens when Facebook does something like this, where it can change the way that you vote? And it can do this in a number of ways. One, the political ads that are shown, like AOC just kind of spelled out in the question. Next, this echo chamber idea, because that's what Facebook and the other social media applications do, is they put you in an echo chamber because they are more likely to show you content either that you'll very much agree with or that you really disagree with and you want to engage with. There's not a whole lot of room of nuance in those algorithms and how they work. And so the upshot is what part of the thing that has happened is that social media has caused a division. You're more likely to be in with people that are your own team and be shown caricatures of the other side because it's really engaging and your team loves pouncing on how stupid the Democrats or the Republicans are. One thing that I really wanted to spell out was that Facebook, this is not like a theoretical idea that Facebook can change the way that you vote. Facebook was kind enough to do some academic study before it was as big as it is now and under as much heat as it is now about how this happened, how this could happen. And what the study showed was that when, so Facebook, this is also a great thing, which is that they used their whole member base as at the time as kind of test subjects without, you know, obviously giving them a heads up. But 61 million voters in the 2012 midterms. Facebook ran a live study, kind of like A-B testing, where they tried different ways of changing those voters' behavior by showing them different things. And they landed on the most successful thing, which is showing people pictures of their friends next to the vote button, or the button that you click to show that you had voted. And they calculated that they got an extra 340,000 people to vote who otherwise would not have voted. So Facebook, with, you know, an impressively rigorous academic study, have demonstrated their own ability to be influential in elections. And that was in 2012. Facebook is much bigger now. Its AI is much better. And I think we should be a bit scared about how that kind of technology can be used to erode democracy. And like I have up there, we've got the Cambridge Analytica legacy. And I'm not going to spend forever on this because I know this has been like quite done over the last few years. But I just thought I'd end this idea that Facebook and Google can and have encroached on the public square. I thought I'd leave you with this very accurate tape, which is from the managing director of Cambridge Analytica, Mark Turnbull. And this is a setup, a sting operation. So he's being taped. He doesn't. He thinks he's talking to a new client about Cambridge Analytica's services. And Cambridge Analytica, for those of you who might have forgotten, is a Facebook, I mean, I don't know what you want to call them, maybe a politics consultancy would be the generous way of putting it, where they use Facebook and weaponize Facebook in order to change the outcome of elections for one particular side. And this is them caught on tape kind of talking about their view on that.
Another meeting was arranged, and this time, a fortnight later at a different London hotel, we get from Cambridge Analytica a memorable lesson in modern electoral tactics.
The two fundamental human drivers when it comes to taking information on board effectively are hopes and fears, and many of those are unspoken and even unconscious. You didn't know that was a fear until you saw something that just evoked that reaction from you.
Right, right.
And our job is to get is to drop the bucket further down the well than anybody else, to understand what are those really deep-seated underlying fears, concerns. There's no good fighting an election campaign on the facts, because actually it's all about emotion.
And in one of their recent...
So yeah, obviously he's like a Bond villain. So even if you move away from how hilariously and clearly awful the man is, and Cambridge Analytica self-destructed in a very public way. But what I want to, one of the things I would like to leave you with this evening is the fact that for all that Cambridge Analytica self-destructed, the actual tool and the capacity to do what they did or claim to do is still around and will only get more and more effective, because this is a very ongoing, Cambridge Analytica was caught, but there are many other kinds of agencies doing the same kind of shady work that Cambridge Analytica is doing, and it's very hard to track and really stop that from happening unless you ban political advertising on Facebook and other social media, which is something that I think should happen. And I guess that's part of the thing that really gets me quite concerned is the idea that you will be able to work out exactly what someone is scared of and then deliver them content that will evoke that fear. Perhaps it's of immigrants, perhaps it's of another minority. You can evoke that fear and cause them to vote a particular way, and they might not be aware of it. And at that point, elections lose just huge amounts of integrity, or the integrity that they have now, because you're then turning over how people are voting to these kinds of shady operators that understand much better than lawmakers how powerful Facebook and micro-targeting can be. On that point, we'll talk about Moore's Law and state law. I had an animation. Okay, so when I talk about Moore's Law, like I said before, it's this idea that it's shorthand for the idea that every 2 years, the computing power on a chip will double. So the efficiency, the kinds of applications you can build, and then the exponential growth from that follows as a consequence. Now, lots of you in the room will be lawyers. I wonder how many of you will agree that lawmaking gets twice as efficient every 2 years. You know, and part of the issue here is that technology has come at a breakneck pace, changed the way, like I've spelled out today, how we trade information, how we have relationships, how we get our understanding of the world, while lawmakers have treated it like a toy or treated the internet as some plaything. And I think that has caused Facebook and Google to be able to build these very deep moats around themselves. And they've effectively, in my view, turned themselves into monopolies. I mean, we could get quite legalistic about that monopoly question, but just at a high level, Facebook and Google control the digital ad market. They control web search. They control messaging. They also do things that you associate with monopolistic bullies, which is they buy their competitors. So Facebook and Google talk quite a lot about being very innovative, and they are, but I think a missed point in the debate is how Facebook and Google, despite being incredibly innovative, stifle innovation. How do they do that? Well, if you're Facebook and you see an up-and-coming competitor, Instagram, and you buy it, that is a possible competitor to your company that is actually not going to develop its own ad system anymore, or the extent to which it's going to develop its own systems very safely and securely within the Facebook bubble, kind of sending the same data through the algorithms to mine for predictions. And then Instagram does not break out and do its own thing because it gets caught within that Facebook umbrella. And this is classic monopoly behavior when you are big enough that you can bully smaller companies and acquire them and essentially stop smaller innovators from innovating in a way that they can then compete with you. There's another great example with Australia I'm not necessarily a huge fan of what Australia were proposing, and I think it was a little bit clunky, but at the end of the day, what Australia were proposing was to make Facebook and Google pay royalties to media companies when they link to news sites. And the key thing there is Facebook held their ground, and Facebook said, we're not going to pay royalties, and they pulled news from Facebook. So anyone in Australia for a period of time couldn't get any news. Eventually, they settled and they negotiated, and there was money changed hands, and they came out with a consensus. But I think that is kind of an alarming idea that a company is so powerful that when regulation comes along, and this is not even very scary regulation, it's like pay royalty, like fractions of Facebook's net worth to media companies, Facebook can hold its ground against a state and say, nope, we don't like that regulation. And can you think about how the Australian government would have responded if Facebook had said it will pull its services entirely? I guess what I would say is that Facebook is now so ingrained in Australian and most people's lives that if Facebook were to threaten to do that, Australia would not have been able to negotiate from that position because Facebook has become such a key part of so many people's lives. People would probably campaign against the government for taking away Facebook. You can see how that would turn out. And so that's another part of this monopoly game, right, is that Facebook and Google have become so powerful, they dominate markets, they can buy their competitors, they stifle innovation, and they're powerful enough to credibly fight states. And that makes regulating them very hard. The last thing I'd say on this Moore's Law versus states law idea is, while regulation is starting to come along, and I'm going to cover that in the next slide. We shouldn't think that Facebook and Google are holding still either, because technology, that's technology's thing. It continues to develop. It develops in exponential ways, and Facebook and Google in their own ways are doing things to bring more and more things into their public, into their digital sphere. So very small example, or possibly a big example, is Facebook with Libra and then Diem trying to bring finance with their own currency, bring finance into their own orbits. Google owns DeepMind. DeepMind is the most advanced AI studio in the world. They have some of the most advanced AI developers in the entire world, and they work under Google. And you can kind of get what that might mean in the context of everything else that we've talked about in terms of data and the importance of algorithms for developing that. So for instance, if those DeepMind engineers do what they're aiming to do, which is develop a general AI, i.e. an AI with a genuinely human level intelligence and ability to do different things, that again would sit within Google and sit within Google's empire. So it's another reason that they're is a need for haste, I think, in terms of regulating Facebook and Google. It's all part of their power. Right, so where to from here? For all that I just kind of talked about how slow and glacial regulation has been, and that is true, and it has enabled Facebook and Google to build up their monopolies, there are things that are happening. So the GDPR in the EU, which is a form of data protection and privacy protection, there was a landmark moment in terms of actually substantively stopping some of the practices that Facebook and Google were doing. And so for instance, whenever you go onto a website now and you have to click terms and conditions and consent and that kind of thing, that's an actual consequence of the GDPR. Obviously, it hasn't stopped or halted the progress of Facebook and Google too much, but the EU is doing stuff, is my point. Last week, they proposed, they're not finalized yet, new rules on AI, and that could have a number of different effects on that business model. One of them is that AI use is banned for manipulative, addictive, social control practices. And I'm sure lawyers will go back and forth for many years about whether or which of Facebook and Google services should be regulated under that particular provision and those kinds of provisions. But it's a progress. It's a sign that the EU, more than anywhere else in the world, takes the kinds of challenges that I've talked about in this seminar seriously and are taking steps. The US, a bit slower, they're doing their own thing with antitrust, which is competition law, and they're trying to go after Facebook and Google on more traditional monopolistic grounds, essentially saying that they're promoting their own services, they're stifling innovation, some of the things they talked about in the last slide. Lastly, what are some other good ideas? Again, I talk about this for a long time in terms of where I think we need to go. I'll restrict myself to just two things. One is there are some issues that are really hard here in terms of, I think that sometimes when there are people like me who are a bit critical of Facebook and Google, can be too quick to jump to solutions and not understand how hard it is to regulate these companies. For instance, let's say we passed a massive ban on data collection and we said no data collection of personal data. That might seem like it would work and would stop Facebook and Google from continuing to build that moat. But do you know what you actually do? You cement Facebook and Google's existing moat of data, and you stop any other tech company from getting their own data to then compete with Facebook and Google. And so, for instance, Google will then have the best search for all time. You know, it's very, you got to be careful with how these regulations work. So that's a little bit of context. One thing that I think we should do is ban political targeting. Like I said earlier, I'm very scared at the possibility for micro-targeting to hit fears and anxieties that we might not know that we have, but might shape the way that we vote. And I think it once we get to that point, we start to, I think, rapidly erode legitimacy in elections because we don't necessarily understand the forces that are influencing how we vote. And if we're spending all our time online, those can be very powerful influences on how we think. So I really think that political advertising, it's got to go. And it's something that, for all I talked about nuance, I think that's something that you actually can a little bit more cleanly just say, okay, we're just going to draw the line in the sand and say political advertising by campaigns and political campaigners, not okay. The last thing, and maybe something I'll just actually leave you with, is thinking through some of the design of digital platforms. So I'm sure some of you watched The Social Dilemma on Netflix. I did, really liked it. But one thing that frustrated me with The Social Dilemma is how they do, maybe like I have, a bit of a diatribe, you know, a great monologue about Facebook and Google, and then they end it by telling you to go on your phone less and, you know, like, don't, like, turn notifications off. And though that is such a tiny nudge in the sea change of systematic incentives and other things going on, and what I would rather we had a conversation with, like, it's great if you can delete Facebook from your phone, I would rather we had a conversation about what kind of infrastructure we want these digital platforms to operate on. So like I said, we take some of these things for granted, the things that hit us with serotonin, the infinite scroll, the notifications, all of those things. If we started to have a discussion about whether those are okay, or whether we actually think that we need to reconsider this whole thing, like, what kinds of digital platforms are we okay with? What, how do we want them to function? My final line that I've written myself is thinking about what we value. So I think that's probably the most productive way to go forward in the conversation. So thinking, if we value, for instance, free choice in an election and not being influenced by forces that we cannot see, that seems like a line in the sand that we can then regulate around. Other things like privacy, like how much information as a society are we comfortable with private companies having? I think, for instance, Sergey Brin's sort of vision of Google having all the information and being able to tell exactly how you'll think, that's way too far. But there is a continuum, and I think that's a really important spectrum to consider. Where do we want to sit on that continuum in terms of how much personal information companies should have? But yeah, so that's the thought I'd leave you with. Facebook and Google, are they too powerful? Like I said, it's a little bit clickbaiting, but we've got a few different more granular discussions that we can kind of work through. This idea about data and choice and the extent to which we are actually choosing to give Facebook and Google the data that we are, and then what they do with it. This idea of the public square. How much do we want to protect the public square from encroachments from Facebook and Google? And to the extent that Facebook and Google have already become the public square, what do we want in terms of how that square operates, what algorithms do, and that kind of thing? And then lastly, in terms of the monopolistic stuff, are we really happy? Like, they are terrific businesses in terms of creating new stuff, but do we think they go too far in terms of stifling innovation? Those are three avenues of thought for us. And yeah, that's basically all I have. And now I thought, had some questions. And Marianne, I believe, is going to, I believe Marianne is going to come around with a mic for people who have questions. And we can have a discussion. Who's got questions?
Question. Okay. That's reality. So I do political advertising. We have a by-election happening at the moment in Auckland for Albert Eden Local Board, and I'm involved with City Vision, which is the progressive Labour Green group. And I could target an ad at people that live in that electorate that are Labour Party members, Green Party, except I can't with Facebook. It's blocking it, blocking it, blocking it. So it used to be extremely easy, and my, you know, tiny little thing here in Auckland is currently being blocked by Facebook. But all I have to do is form, I don't know, Mount Eden Parents Group, and I can run the ads again easily through that. So humans are, you know, there's so many ways to beat the system. And if you look at the biggest spenders in America right now, it'll be like, I think Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight was massive. So
yeah,
you can always find another way through the whatever rule they set up. People can always figure out how to do it. And I love political advertising. It's fantastic for what we're trying to do. But when it's on your side, it's good. But when it's on your side, it ain't too much.
Yeah, that's a really good comment.
Just
have a query from the background. My microphone's working. I can do without. I've only worked in this area for about 35 years, so I only know what I know. What we're seeing often with Facebook now and modern technology is merely a rehash of things that have been around before. You know, the whole idea of trading or eBay is no different from my grandfather buying things in the middle of nowhere, sending a telegram down to the local store and the stuff turning up in the dray on a train in the 1880s. Facebook is merely appears to be merely a very efficient aggregation of data, analogous to these German Stasi. One of the questions that people who use social media have to ask is, why are they happily and willingly providing data through an electronic intermediary where much of the communication can be done face-to-face very discreetly? If you want someone else to know anything about you, give it to a third party, which is exactly what you're doing. The right comparison to the guard also to control the Facebook and Google in China with Weibo and Russia's also has particular issues. So you do have choices whether you put Facebook out, whether you use Facebook. I personally do not. I've had dealings with the internal lawyers of the companies that you mentioned. A classic case for anyone to look at who's a law student is a case involving an American woman judge who did not disclose the particular unfortunate photographs of herself, extreme pornography posted by her husband, appeared when filling out an application form for the Canadian judicial federal application. Was there anything you ought to disclose would bring yourself or the judiciary into disrepute? She took no. The Canadian Judicial Council then spent 4 years and nearly $4 million having her removed from the bench.
I guess one thing I'd say is I think it's really good when people make individual decisions to do things like remove themselves from Facebook, make personal decisions to stop the third party, like you say, having access to their data. But I think we need to be realistic about the fact that very few people are going to take the kind of the high road there. And so that's kind of why when I was talking about that, I think understanding the ways in which Facebook has these very strong feedback loops that will bring in most people. And so I think the first thing to say is a lot of people don't quite appreciate the extent to which their data is being used in this way. And Facebook, for certain, is not particularly forthcoming with some of the ways in which they use their data. But the second is, even if you've watched The Social Dilemma and you understand, have a sense of this kind of thing, it's not as easy to leave as we might think, whether it's because it's addictive or whether it's because it's something as simple as you're 16 and all your friends are on it and they're going to plan an event and they can't invite you if they're not on Facebook. You know, simple things like that add up to really powerful network effects.
They're very efficient. I lived in Germany just after the wall came down and people got access to the 2 million Manila folders. Much of the information on there is the same as people are now giving away. And it was all about state control in that case. In reality here, it's commercial control for a commercial gain. But in the end, for the same end, it's retaining power and control. You can decide whether you want to willingly give data. And again, the core thing is also that databases are designed on the Irish principle. They're neither forgive nor forget, and any perceived slack, no matter how long ago it happened, will be treated as though it's 5 seconds ago. It can come back and haunt you in your professional life 30 years later.
Thanks for that. Are there other questions? Jane, hello.
That was lovely, thanks Matt. I have a question though about the contrast between Moore's law and state law. Because I think as lawyers, what we are increasingly finding is that state law is impotent to deal with many of the challenges that we've identified, whether it's tax law or competition law or privacy law or regulating alcohol or whatever. And that's a problem in itself, but in the little...
I've just got an hour, Jane.
In the little zone that I work in, which is the international trade rules, what we've seen is a very deliberate and effective move since 2010 by GAFA, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, to globalize the US regulation-free zone of the internet. And so now we have countries, including our own, signing up in the name of e-commerce trade rules or digital trade rules, commitments not to regulate, for example, requiring the disclosure of source codes or algorithms that mean you can check whether, in fact, they're compliant with that regulation, not requiring them to have a local presence in your country so they're subject to your jurisdiction, not requiring them to hold the data even in a country where you have some sense of there being some form of a regulatory regime. And so, you know, I think we've got to start thinking across the different layers of regulation, because we tend to be very siloed and we tend to be very state-centric, and they are not. Yeah, and so I think we need to look at that. And the last point I'd make is that in the Waitangi Tribunal, we've just had, in the final part of the challenge on the TPPA, the digital issues. And for Māori, the issues are much deeper, because data is not commodity, asset, individualised, personal information. It's whakapapa, it carries with it a whole range of collective consequences and so on. And so it requires us to think completely outside the regulatory and legal boxes that we're used to.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And one thing that I didn't mention, I think it's running out of time, and that idea of Moore's law and state law, and also thinking about how we've got to this position, don't underestimate the ways in which Facebook and Google have wormed their ways into the regulatory scene with their own kinds of operatives. I think because they've done a very good job at being kind of flashy tech companies, it's very easy to talk about, like, you know, the coal businesses and their lobbyists, and then ignore the fact that Facebook and Google outspend all of them. You know, Facebook and Google have spent an enormous amount of money on lobbyists, and that has done quite a lot to slow the pace of regulation and change how it is brought in when it is brought in. And there are Jane's right, the other thing to think about here is needing to think outside the box. It is very clear, hopefully it was clear from my seminar, that regulation has been woefully inadequate at really grappling with the actual issues here. Obviously, competition, antitrust, monopoly, that is one part to the puzzle. But what I've tried to talk about tonight is this broader picture, things like the public square, things that maybe we should value and we want to think outside the square, in terms of maybe because this is a new paradigm, maybe we need new kinds of laws. Great point, Jane.
Hi.
Hi.
Just got a quick question. What do you think of the idea of these companies paying us dividends for sharing our personal information, or like royalties?
Yeah, it's not a terrible idea at all. And I say that because that's one of the proposed solutions out there. Basically, these things called data unions. So one idea is that because it's so hard for individuals to negotiate with Facebook and Google, maybe we should kind of unionize or have data unions of millions of people. They negotiate with Facebook and Google, and maybe one of the things that they do when they're negotiating with Facebook and Google is say, okay, you can have access to our these unionists' data, but on these terms and in exchange for this compensation. You know, obviously, because it is hard to see how it plays out, because that's just because it's such a radical change to the current relationship we have between users and platforms. I wonder if we will eventually get to a point where we look at options like that, and data is treated like a commodity, like oil.
Ultimately, though, data unions probably aren't going to have much effect if even Australia doesn't have much bargaining. I think you made a really good point, and that leads into Jane's point that maybe the only way to regulate them is for multiple countries to do so all at once, because really, if New Zealand were to pass a law that Facebook didn't like, then we wouldn't really probably, you know, be able to use Facebook for very long. They'd probably just be able to cut us off. I was listening to a Zoom seminar by a professor of economics called Nicholas Economides from NYU a couple of weeks ago, And he said that us selling our data for free to Facebook and Google is a market failure. In economic terms, there would be some groups of people who would charge, you know, a certain amount for that. Some people would rate their privacy very highly and would want to charge a lot for that. They force us down to nothing because of their market power. And what's happening is that there are really two markets. There's a market where consumers sell their data for free to Facebook in return for the services that they provide us. And there's the other market, which is almost invisible to the consumers, which is the market that you were describing, where they're selling predictions to advertisers. And because those two markets are linked, this is the market failure he was talking about. What we need to do is to separate those two markets. You'd need to have some kind of law. As Jane says, it wouldn't work just on a country-by-country basis. You'd need to have some kind of law that would prevent any advertiser from paying any money to Google and Facebook. That's the only way we would be able to stop this from happening, and it wouldn't be able to be done just by one country. There isn't much more in terms of, I mean, there's a few legal things that we can do. I've been researching this area since probably 2008 and publishing on it. And there are some things that the Supreme Court of Canada is doing about. Recently, they're starting to fight back a little bit. Like they refuse to enforce a forum selection clause. Facebook's forum selection clause not liked by the Supreme Court of Canada. So they're refusing to enforce some of the clauses in these terms and conditions that we seem to have no choice but to agree to. So there are some legal things, but really they're not going to have much effect on Facebook and Google's market power unless there's some kind of regulation, and like you say, in a completely different way than we have done before.
Yeah, I'd agree with it.
Can I disagree as well, though? Because we've been dealing with this in the tax area, for example. And tax evasion by these companies is legion. But the OECD, the US, has blocked the development of a collective tax mechanism for the digital companies. And so a number of countries have introduced digital services taxes. And the US has brought Section 301 Trade Act investigations against them and tariff retaliation, France, India, and so on. And so we have got, you've got a failure of global regulation, and you have got countries who are taking those initiatives and getting retaliation, but the more countries that are doing it, the more space there's going to be for it. So it's not a either or, it's a very iterative political process.
Yeah, it's a good point. One thing I think was raised, and I didn't talk about it in this seminar, but the China example is also quite instructive, and that is actually, for all that you may walk away thinking that Facebook and Google are worse than you thought, there's some terrifying stuff going on in China, and that is what Facebook and Google use politically. They say, look at China. They've got not a Black Mirror episode, they have a social credit score, and that's based on lots of the same data points that Facebook and Google are collecting, and Facebook and Google kind of say, well, look, is that what you want? Do you want centralized control of all that data running through the Chinese government to do what they wish? And that's all part of the gamesmanship on a political level. And that's what it is. It is gamesmanship. The EU has been stronger on this than the US. But I think for a long time, the US has been kowtowed by the tech companies saying, don't regulate us. We need to evolve because we are the capitalist alternative to China, and I think it's been very effective politically for them.
Right. Yeah, I just question the efficacy of taxing Facebook, given structural features mean that they can run at losses, they can sustain that kind of thing and still be successful, particularly given the returns to scale. So I'm not, and particularly given how large the revenue are and how a tax would be such a small slice of that, how that would resolve the data issue.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily advocating for it. Yeah. No, that's a good point.
I'm also quite interested in the public space idea. And one of the counter arguments I've come across is the whole thing around the marketplace of ideas, which is that, yeah, sure, people do lie, but it's up to the market response is for people, other people, to tell the truth. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, there are a lot of things you could say in response to that. The first is that it's quite theoretical, this idea that, like, it's very kind of classic freedom of expression. People should be able to say whatever they want and then the truth will emerge. And the reality is that is not what happens. And especially given that, like I was saying, this is not a neutral square. So the outrageous stuff, the misinformation, that is picked up and accelerated by the algorithms in a way that, you know, gentle, reasoned, academic discussion about, you know, things that we might think might happen in the marketplace of ideas. And to be totally fair, I think there is possibly something to be said for Facebook and Google and other actors' removal of gatekeepers, and that's kind of resulted in kind of the mess that we talked about. But there are positives, so allowing anyone to get on and say their piece can give a voice to people who may otherwise not have had their voice heard and give them a chance at going viral and building influence and all those things. So there are nuances here. It's not as simple as it's a terrible marketplace. The marketplace it doesn't exist. But I would say to you that the main response is that structural forces mean that kind of idealized discussion does not happen, and misinformation and hate speech and those kinds of things result instead. Another question.
I was just wondering what you think the relevance of things like the new iOS update are in this space.
Yeah, really good question. I think lots of the things that we're saying in this corner are true, and that it is quite hard to imagine what an effective state law regulatory package would look like that would adequately deal to lots of the issues that we care about. And I think that private responses from companies like Apple, who maybe see in their interest to position themselves against this ecosystem, this kind of business model, I think they have merit. I think it's definitely a good thing what Apple is doing. And it's also interesting, taking a back step, to see Apple position itself oppositionally to Facebook and especially Facebook in that way. I mean, I don't think it's perfect. Like, it's not going to resolve lots of these issues overnight. But yeah, I would say, one, it's a good thing. And two, taking a step back, I mean, given the lackluster state and public response, potentially one of the best things we can hope for is that public pressure and the rise of this as an issue that people are aware of will drive companies like Apple to take privacy-enhancing decisions, or decisions that protect the integrity of the public space. Because the reality is Apple can do a lot more damage to what Facebook and Google can do than most countries can. Question over here.
Hey, Matt. It was a wonderful presentation. So I'm probably going to speak from someone who's grown up in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. In Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, as you would know, both homosexuality and apostasy are illegal. And the state has used its apparatus at times and ways in order to make sure that these companies would provide the state with data. So when you talk about regulation, I'm rather fearful, because I'm like, well, this should never happen. There was a time in Pakistan when people were actually put in jail and put to death because there were people who were blasphemizing against the name of Muhammad and God Almighty, and they were put in jail for that. And the state was using not only the state apparatus, but also requiring that Facebook make sure that people are firstly not able to blasphemize against the name of Muhammad, but also make sure that any such event ought to be reported to the state. And the company was doing that. And this was way back in 2010, when they decided not to do it. Firstly, they weren't doing it. They banned Facebook in 2010 for about a year or 2 years. And then they banned YouTube, because apparently there was some blasphemous content on YouTube. And then they basically allowed both of these, well, when they had an agreement of sorts, they basically allowed them to continue their work. My problem is that if you want regulation, and you're talking about regulation, which is wonderful, we must have regulation. From a Western point of view, yes, entirely different. But from the Eastern point of view, where you do not have free speech to begin with, how do you
makes sense of that?
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's a very vexed question. I'd say the first thing I'd say is just coming back to the China point, which is that when we have this discussion about Facebook and Google, to be aware that centralized state power over that data and the information about people, that is something that we need to do both at the same time, right? We need to say what Facebook and Google are doing now is bad, and we need to maybe think about how to regulate that. But while still thinking that the China and the examples of Saudi Arabia having the access to that kind of data, which is very scary, that is also hard. So I don't necessarily have, I don't have the solution because it is such a vexed issue. But I think one thing is that we need to be able to point to centralized control of that data and say that that has problems and have ways of addressing that, and also at the same time have this discussion around Facebook and Google and less centralized states.
Don't you think it'd rather be a private entity than a state entity? A state entity with its coercive control versus a private entity. They're two entirely different things.
Well, they are and they aren't. In the end point, remember what Sergey Brin said. Google's endpoint is having all the information to predict exactly how you are going to think and how you are going to behave. And that's been the goal for a lot of, centralized authoritarian states as well. Maybe it's, their dream. And if I guess my point is, if an entity has that level of control, data, all the stuff to give them that level of insight, that must be avoided. That must be avoided. It's so bad that I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, we need to take the company, or because the company would be less bad than a state. That's not immediately obvious to me, to be honest with you. I totally understand why that might be the case. But my view would be that they're so bad in different ways that we just need to ensure that neither can happen. And that is very hard, but I think it's the only option, because we can't have companies with that much power, but we also can't have states with that much power.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking about this complex issue. My name is David, and I wanted to ask you about your opinion regarding three different issues: Facebook's profit, okay, Canadian AI tool, and the future of general AI and AA.
Okay, so I think Facebook's profit is, they make too much money, and it comes from bad places. So very, very high level thoughts on Facebook's profit. General AI, so I won't talk about this for too long, but general AI is quite a scary concept in the, when you think about it emerging in an AI studio like DeepMind that is under the Alphabet umbrella. And it is true that Google already uses some of the design work that goes into that DeepMind is trying to work on to get to a general AI. They are using that to make their algorithms better, more predictive, all those things. And I do think that's concerning. It's very hard to regulate, so I would separate that out. That's something I'm scared of. I don't necessarily know what a regulation would do, and I am wary of regulating AI development altogether, and I think that would be bad. So to answer your question, general AI, I think it is scary. It's particularly scary in the context of Google or Facebook deploying the AI for ill or for commercial gain. But I also would caution and say that general AI is likely at the very least 15, 20 years away. If you poll AI engineers, they have different responses, but the median lands in the 2030s or 2040s. I think it's easy to get worried about that picture because it would be quite bad. But in the meantime, with narrow AI, Facebook and Google already have a huge amount of control and influence with the relatively simple AI that they have at the moment. And so I guess where I'd stand is let's deal with that now and then worry about more and more sophisticated general AI at a later date. I'm also conscious that it's 7 o'clock, so I will wrap it up there so you guys can get home. Although I will say that we're hosting a reception in the student common room, which is just down the stairs. So feel free after this, if you'd like a drink, to come and continue the discussion if you'd like then. But thank you all for coming.